long, dark corridor and a half-open steel door. I could see their shadows moving through the crack beyond the door. From where we were watching, the door was roughly 10 meters away. The only thing we could do was bust in there and shoot them. No special tactic, no smart way to handle it. I hated this and wished for a better method. We approached the door. I stopped Gunny and Mac, and we checked our weapons. No safety, and no inhibitions. We had 87 rounds ready to go between us. More if we needed to reload, but we all knew if it came to that, we were going to die anyway. We checked our clothing and tried to cover as much skin as possible. As near as I could figure, there were at least 10 in there, and at least one of the special type. This hatch opened outward, away from us and toward them. I gave the signal, and the gunny kicked it fully open. It slammed against the bulkhead and locked into place. Inside this room were 11 undead corpses. They were all banging on the metal partition and didn't notice us at first until I took a preemptive shot. I killed 3 before the rest took notice. I had hoped that one of them was the New Orleans creature. We began to shoot, 3-round bursts. Limbs, jaws, shoulders, and teeth were flying everywhere. I was careful not to aim in the direction of the partition in case one of the sailors stood near. We were down to 3 when I heard a loud scream from over my right shoulder. It was Mac. He was bleeding from his face, and one of the creatures was standing behind him, attempting to bite him. I looked again. It was the same creature we had shot 2 compartments back, the one we didn't touch, but tried to incapacitate. It hadn't died. I emptied the rest of my magazine into the creature's head. It fell, most of its head missing. I was almost overrun by the last of them when Gunny took care of them for me, as I tended to Mac. The bite wasn't bad. It was actually not his face, but his ear. The creature had bitten part of his ear off. Mac was breathing heavily and going into what I would have described as shock. I asked Gunny to look after him as I went to check for survivors in the galley. This was no time to screw around. The ship wasn't safe and would need a scrub down before it could ever be used in a normal capacity again. I rapped on the steel shutter, asking if anyone was alive. I heard a series of mechanical clicking sounds, and the door next to the shutter opened up and they started pouring out. Living. One of them looked pretty bad. It was the one who had the hand-to-hand altercation with one of the New Orleans creatures. The ship's OIC was present, and I informed him of the situation. He knew it and hated to admit it, but he had no choice but to abandon this ship and hold out on the rig until we could get support from Carrier HQ. We got the hell off the ship, with Mac and the 6 sailor being first priority. Mac was a dead man. The other man had not been bitten and only needed decontamination treatment. I wasn't certain whether it was too late. On the way out, I stopped off in one of the ship's heads and ripped the soap dispenser off the wall. I took a roll of paper towels as well. We were finally topside. It was still dark outside. It was only 0300 hours. Mac and the sailor were in no shape to climb to the platform where the other survivors waited. We rigged a makeshift harness and pulled them up one at a time. I never really knew this Marine, but that doesn't change my sadness. As the acting commander, it was my duty to travel to the camp where his wife lived and tell her the news. Although I had no flag to present, it didn't change the need to fulfill my obligation to Mac, as he is and always will be a United States Marine. Gunny shot Mac in the back of the head 2 hours after we returned to the rig. He had already passed out from the infection and was not far from turning. This mission ended the next day, with radio contact being established with the carrier battle group. I relayed a message to command through the radio operator at Hotel 23 and informed them of the situation and location of survivors here. Using salt water from the Gulf and the soap and towels, we attempted to decontaminate Petty Officer Tom Post. We left the men with every bit of our food and water and departed the oil rig after making sure a rescue was en route. We also left the sailors a functional radio in the event help didn't show. The only thing we had going for us were a few full cans of diesel and a spot to refuel on our charts. It was a two-day trip back. I brought Mac back home, wrapped in canvas, strapped to the exterior of Lav Number 2. I made sure he wouldn't return, but his wife didn't deserve to have his body thrown into the Gulf. He deserved a proper burial. 19 August, 2350 hours. Day before last, I made my trip to the Marine base camp. This is one of the many reasons that I wish I were not the senior man present at the facility. I took four men, including the gunny, and one Lav. Correction. There were five men. Mac was with us in a pine box, covered by an American flag. The flag wasn't easy to come by, as it took 40 rounds of ammunition and 10 years of my life terrified away from me to get it. It was the least I could do. Tara asked to come with me to comfort the widow. I told her that it wasn't a good idea, of course. Besides, this world is so full of death and doom. Mrs. Mac wasn't the only one to lose someone, but I still felt for her. There weren't many pre-existing relationships left here in the apocalypse. I didn't have a formal uniform, and the nearest uniform shop was out of business. I knew it really didn't matter. It was a solemn moment when I handed the widow her tattered one-sided flag. I didn't know what to expect. I had never had the honor of doing this. In the movies, the widow always hugs the guy who gives her the flag, and they both have a somber moment. All I got was a cold stare and a feeling of hatred. Who am I to blame her? If I can somehow be an outlet for her emotions, then it's fine by me. I do know that I feel bad about what happened. He was a good man. R.I.P. Staff Sergeant Mac. Exodus. 21 August. 2057 hours. 1734Z, 22 August. From CDR Nada Missile Facility to USS George Washington --CNO--BT. Secret N --002028U. Subject --SITREP Reliance. Remarks --IAWCMD directives issued by recipient, unit dispatched to rescue of Reliance on predetermined coordinates. Cutter found overrun by undead, with three radiated. All undead destroyed, ship scuttled, rescue authority contacted. Recommend RAD undead not be held on any naval vessel due to inadequate facilities. This unit does not advise RAD dead be housed on board flagship. Please QSL this message and advise. BT, AR, number N0234. 22, August. HQ has not responded to my recent communique. I have released a radio message preparing the other camp for evacuation. This comes after a 36-hour swell of undead near that area. It will take them 2 days to transit to this location with women and children. Here at Hotel 23, we are busy finding supplies to expand our safe boundary so that we can house the extra occupants. There is no way we can accommodate them all inside the facility. It simply wasn't built for so many. The other camp has lost 8 people since I ordered a contingent to be stationed here. I cannot help but think animosity may exist. Apparently, one of the civilian males was allowed to hunt for deer last week and returned with nothing to show for it, but a bite from one of the creatures. The man hid the bite for fear of quarantine or summary execution. He turned in his sleep 3 days later and took the lives of 2 other civilians, 3, if you count the young girl who was executed because she was bitten and getting sick. They didn't shoot her like an animal. They gave her a morphine overdose, and after her heart stopped, they immediately drilled a small hole in her head above her left ear to destroy any chance of reanimation. When this type of thing happens, I lose sleep. I know that millions have died in a much worse manner than this over the past months, but it always hurts to see a young child get taken by this sickness. I don't really even know if that is what it is. Some seem to think so. While monitoring the daily message traffic coming off the archaic dot matrix printer, I saw a message I had been expecting. The ballistic missile submarine that had been submerged since before the plague was forced to surface yesterday. That was the last sanctuary of real death. The last known place on the planet where men could die in peace. Until it surfaced. The man who had died of natural causes and had been stored in the freezer came back after only 2 hours of exposure. Luckily, they had it strapped to a crate of low-grade beef. The ship's cook discovered it when he went down to the freezer to retrieve the last of the ship's food stores. The cook nearly had a heart attack when he walked by the corpse and noticed its head tracking him across the reefer, gnashing its teeth. The submarine intends to follow the battle group until it can acquire enough food to stay submerged for a useful amount of time. Its mission now, instead of blowing up large foreign cities, is to scout coastal areas and discourage piracy on the high seas. The status messages that are sent weekly state that most of the nuclear ships won't need to be refueled for 20-plus years. After that, all bets are off. I doubt there will be enough qualified people to refuel them even in 100 years. I'm sending all our labs out tomorrow to meet the other survivors at the halfway point and to escort them the rest of the way here. From that point, it will take every man, woman, and child to expand our safe boundaries. We will have no choice but to make perilous trips to the surrounding interstates to retrieve concrete barriers so that we may better fortify our compound. Tara and I have been spending more time together than ever since my return from the Gulf. Dean has been dubbed the official teacher of this compound. Of course, there are only 2 children to teach, but soon there will be more. Annabelle is allowed to attend class on the stipulation she does not bark and disrupt the instruction. I sat in on one of the classes last night. Laura is becoming pretty decent at her multiplication tables. Danny is a little better due to age. She is learning her sevens, and Danny is up to division and fractions. Jan is still the resident nurse and helps out a lot when some of the men come back with bumps, scratches, and bruises. John and I have not had much time together lately. I remember, in the beginning, he was all I had. I suppose I will never forget that. Sometimes, when I daydream, I can see John on his roof with his thermos and large rubber yoga band. I can only see it in black and white in my mind, as if it happened ages ago. I wonder what the response will be from the carrier now that they know we had to destroy the creatures to save the rest of the crew. 05, September. 20:36 hours. 60%. That is the number of survivors we have here from the other marine outpost. Many are civilians. It was a constant battle to get them here. The chain-link fence surrounding the silo area is packed with makeshift tents and survivors. Hotel 23 is very much over capacity for the interior to handle. After their arrival 10 days ago, an accurate muster was taken. We came up with 113 souls. The Marines sent to rendezvous with the other camp at the halfway point met extreme opposition. The convoy was moving slowly to accommodate the civilians who were on foot. Many rode scavenged bicycles to keep up with the armored vehicles in the front and rear of the convoy. The women and children were first to be allowed to ride. The bulk of the casualties came from attacks perpendicular to the formation line. The undead came out of the thick underbrush and picked off many men with only scrapes and bites. Most men held on and kept contributing to the security of the convoy, despite the death sentence dealt to them by the bites. Others simply walked off into the underbrush and committed suicide. The convoy was low on ammunition by the time it pulled into Hotel 23. They were in constant firefights the whole way, pushing back the surge of cold hands reaching over the railings of the vehicles. The convoy did its best to distract the dead away from Hotel 23 before circling back to the compound. The tactic seemed to work, but I have noticed a steady increase in activity since the others arrived. I have been forced to order squads of fencemen to the chain-link perimeter to kill them. In large numbers, they could buckle the fence. This is the main reason I have organized a team of individuals for missions to the interstate. That gridlocked infinity of concrete barriers holds the key to our temporary survival. We needed the hundreds of concrete barriers present there to reinforce our boundaries to hold the new survivors safely within the fence line. The most difficult part was getting the equipment needed to transport the barriers. We needed flatbed tractor trailers and forklifts. Only a few men in the compound were former forklift operators. We were able to acquire 4 propane-powered forklifts from a lumber yard near the interstate. We have also scavenged and repaired 2 flatbed tractor trailers to transport the barriers. Only 2 truckloads of barriers have arrived since the operation started. The progress is slow but steady. I estimate the fence would hold up to 5 deep. Any more ghouls than that would force the fence to cave inward, and our new citizens would surely perish. I have given up my living space to the women and children. I have only permitted women who have volunteered to remain topside. Tara insisted that she stay with me. I am okay with this because I cannot let the other women volunteers stay here and discriminate against her. Last week, I transmitted a formal request for a helicopter equipped with anti-personnel weapons and a pilot to be transferred to the compound to help police the perimeter against a large influx of undead. I over-justified the need to ensure that our request be met. We needed some form of air power for both security and reconnaissance in this area. Fixed wing would be out of the question, and more trouble than it's worth due to maintenance and the requirement for 5,000 feet of runway. We'll see what happens. Dragonfly. 07 September. 18:37 hours. This morning, I received a message indicating authorization of a rotary wing aircraft, 1 pilot, and 1 maintenance person to be transferred to Hotel 23. The message did not state what model, but it did state the aircraft was due for arrival tomorrow morning. This aircraft will not only strengthen our perimeter defenses, but will also make it easier to scout for essential supplies. Depending on the range of the aircraft, I plan to fly northward to scout non-radiated cities. I will post a notice in the common area both above and below ground for people to list items of which they are in dire need. Certain medical prescriptions, eyeglasses, or possibly female products come to mind. I'm excited to take to the air again. I have not flown in ages, and the Cessna parked at the edge of the field is probably not safe to operate. I know one of the gear brakes is not functioning properly, and the engine needs a detailed checkup that it most likely will never receive. I almost feel as if I'm putting the cart miles before the horse by thinking of ways to use the helicopter. It isn't even here. John and I played a nice game of chess today in the control room. Dean has a respectable-sized class of young men and women now, including the original 2. She now has 14 students. Annabelle does not fancy all the new children in Dean's class. Dean will have to break up the time spent by age groups, as I have noticed that ABCs are a little too elementary for some of the older kids. I stepped in today and heard Mozart flowing through the air. The children were listening attentively. Who would have thought? A year ago, the whole room would have been moaning in protest. Considering the terrors these children have witnessed, the beauty of the music was actually making them smile. I thought back to the last time I had listened to Mozart, but didn't hang on to the thought long. Secure space is at a premium inside the compound, and Jan has her medical tent set up topside. Only the really sick or injured get to stay down below within the safe steel sanctuary. Not a bad system. Lately, the only thing she has had to deal with is minor cuts and abrasions. I have a standing order to be notified of all injuries reported to the resident medic. I have tasked the originals with the duty of drafting a book of rules for Hotel 23. Of course, the Uniform Code of Military Justice will be followed, but I feel a need for this compound to have its own bylaws that the people should follow. Seems silly, the need for rules these days. I almost feel like I am rebuilding a government within the compound. Of course, any regulation created and imposed will be based strictly on the Constitution of the United States. 08 September, 1800 hours. Today, one MH-60R Seahawk helicopter, along with the allocated personnel, arrived. The pilot, a retired Navy commander by the name of Thomas Behem, was the pilot in command. His maintenance person, an active-duty Navy petty officer, was to be the non-com in charge of keeping the aircraft airworthy until more parts and personnel could be flown in. My first action was to inquire about the condition of the aircraft, as I planned to execute some airborne recon in the coming weeks. Commander retired Behem was a volunteer. He willingly gave up his safer job with the carrier battle group to relocate to southeastern Texas and work with us at Hotel 23. Although an older man in his late 50s, he still had the fire and drive in his eyes. I had secretly wished he were active duty and thus would be lawfully in command of Hotel 23 as the senior officer. The Seahawk was a rather large helicopter. The petty officer told me that the range was 380 miles. On the way to the compound, they flew by numerous abandoned military airfields that they suspected had at least some JP-5, a common military aircraft fuel. This type of fuel had its advantages, as it didn't spoil nearly as rapidly as conventional gasoline. It would still be usable if found inside a fuel truck. I had a message drafted to HQ the moment the chopper reported. Although I did thank them for the aircraft, I also requested more parts and personnel to maintain it. Tomorrow, I would like to head out with Behem and the flight engineer to survey the surrounding area for useful intelligence. 11 September, 2354 hours. Today marks another anniversary of the day I thought it couldn't get any worse. I suppose times like these make me wish I were back in that time, when the world had no idea what terror was. Undead movement is still growing in the surrounding areas. I feel that there is virtually no chance of survivors in any major city at this point. Of course, the ones that were nuked would be void of survivors. My reasoning is simple. The undead seem to be fanning out away from major areas into mass mobile formations. I am sure the cities that are still intact have a concentration of undead, but they have probably been out of food for a couple of months. This could have prompted them to leave their native areas and search for prey. I could be totally wrong in this theory. Behem has conveyed that the aircraft is ready for recon missions. We have discussed the areas that would be good candidates for survey. Ruling out any areas that have been bombed, we have decided to head north by northeast. Our destination will be Texarkana. This is the safest area to survey while avoiding the undead and radiated cities. According to the charts, Texarkana was not a high population area, and the nearest nuked city to that destination is Dallas, Texas. This gives us roughly 120 miles of safe distance. Unfortunately, due to the distance, we will need to find fuel. It's 240 nautical miles one way from here to Texarkana. 15 September, 2219 hours. The aircraft performed well in today's scouting mission. We did not make the long journey north to Texarkana. However, we did find a suitable area to refuel the helicopter. We went north to Shreveport, Louisiana. We had nothing to guide our way, sans the Inertial Navigation System, INS. The INS is a self-contained gyroscopic navigation device that does not rely on any outside information for aircraft navigation. As long as you give the INS a good latitude and longitude before you take off, the INS will keep an accurate gyroscopic position the entire flight. Since the GPS satellites have long failed, it would have been nearly impossible to find Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport without the INS. We would have run out of fuel long before we reached our destination. We only had 45 minutes of fuel left when we were over the base. The fence was damaged in some areas, but still held. The undead were heavy on the northern side of the base perimeter fence. As we neared the aircraft parking spots, I could see numerous B-52 bombers parked in neat rows outside the hangars. Some of the planes still had bombs sitting on carts underneath. I was not certain, but I had a feeling the bombs that were sitting under those aircraft were not conventional. The pilots just never got the chance to take off and accomplish their assigned bombing package. The aircraft are useless in our current situation. They would require too much fuel and maintenance to be of any survival value. I suppose if we had a qualified or suicidal pilot to fly the bomber, we could remove the extra payloads and fly it overseas, but it would be a one-way trip, as I was certain that it would require professional maintenance after such a long flight. I did feel a sting of patriotism as I gazed upon their decadence. I wondered if any of them had flown over the Hanoi Hilton, giving at least some comfort to the guests. We were hovering over a forgotten piece of United States diplomacy. Now the buffs were a decaying museum exhibit. We counted 27 corpses inside the airfield perimeter. There were two fuel trucks, one marked JP-5 and the other marked JP-8, sitting on the median between the runway and taxiway. Since we were on a skeleton crew to conserve fuel, we only had the pilot, the flight engineer, the gunny, and myself on board. The gunny and I had to cover the flight engineer, F.E., while he fueled the helicopter. This was an operation that would require the aircraft to remain running. This is not a normal procedure, but no chances can be taken. As we fueled the chopper, a dozen undead approached, attracted to the sound of the rotors spinning. That sound was extremely loud, and the gunny and I had to rely solely on sight to detect and eliminate them. I stood aft, a safe distance from the tail rotor, and the gunny held the forward position. Our shots could barely be heard over the turbine engines and the swinging blades. I was wearing my helmet with the visor down. The helmet served multiple purposes on board the aircraft and off. It helped shield my ears from the harmful decibels that pierced the immediate area and saved my eyes from flying FOD. Using my weapon, I was able to neutralize most of the undead with only single shots. None of them moved with the same quickness as their radiated counterparts. The gunny was using the MP5SD. I hated that weapon for its accuracy and lack of stopping piercing power, but it was useful because of the silence factor. The only other advantage it had was the ability to interchange ammunition with the gunny's M9 pistol. As I dispatched the last of the undead approaching my end of the aircraft, I moved forward to help out with the increasing numbers there. I had a better killing range with my weapon. I used this advantage to destroy the walkers that were 100 yards out and closing on our position. The engineer gave us the thumbs up, indicating that he had successfully refueled the aircraft. I wondered how he got the fuel truck started, and later found out that he had carried a portable starter to the truck. He had faced this same situation before and had been prepared. After the engineer was safely back in the helicopter, I plugged my helmet back into the aircraft's communications system and informed the pilot that the gunny and I were going to scout the immediate area for any useful items or information. I asked him to keep it hot until we got back for dust-off. The pilot keyed the microphone and told me he and the flight engineer could handle security while we were gone, and that they would take off and circle the airfield until bingo fuel if we were not back within 1 hour. I secured the side door and waved goodbye as the gunny and I set out for one of the larger buildings nearest to our position. There were no external markings. It was just another bland government building, lacking any detail that would give away purpose. As we neared the structure, we knew it would be suicide to explore. In nearly all of the windows, the shades had been yanked down from the wall, exposing the occupants inside. Some of the windows were spiderwebbed with abuse from the punishment they had received in the past months. There were too many undead inside the building to count. Since noise wasn't a factor, I readied my weapon and took a pot shot at one of them on the top floor. It was banging on the window with both fists until my shot cut through the window. I missed the creature, and it looked at the new hole in the window with the curiousness of a cat looking at a laser pointer. I scoffed at this, and the gunny and I began our return to the chopper. As we turned, I could see and hear the F.E. taking shots at an approaching group of undead with the side-mounted machine gun. Great for close encounters. The ride back was uneventful, but any time I could spend in the air was fine by me. I even got some stick time in the co-pilot's seat. It would take a lot more than this to make me semi-proficient at maneuvering this aircraft, as it was the hardest thing I'd ever flown. I looked like an idiot as I tried to hover the beast. Bayham had to take over every time. 25 September. 1900 hours. It finally happened. I won't cheapen the experience by putting it into writing. Last night was a good night, and I feel more human already. Part of me would like to think I cared about her the moment I found her trapped in the broken-down car that day, surrounded by the creatures. Despite her less than glamorous living arrangement in the car, she was pretty even then. 29 September, 22:39 hours. The time has been set. Tomorrow morning, I will set out with the gunny, engineer, and commander-retired Bayham in the chopper in the direction of Shreveport again. We have decided to survey the area around Barksdale Air Force Base, since the base had an ample supply of helicopter fuel. Texarkana would not be the goal of our expedition this time. John had begged to go with me, as he really wanted to get out of the compound for a couple of days. I had assured him that I really needed him manning the control center and for the basic organization of the civilians. He was not a military man, but the men respected him and appreciated him for his knowledge of the base systems. After dinner, he insisted that I memorize a series of code words so that I could transmit my location in the clear using letter and number association. Annabelle is enjoying herself with all the new children in the compound. The gunny and I are leaving military command to one of the most senior staff sergeants and civilian leadership to John. There are rules governing who has what authority in the compound, and the military men know too well that, constitutionally, their job is still to protect civilians, not run roughshod over them just because they have firepower. There is also a team of men working on the new perimeter. Trucks come and go daily with new concrete dividers from I-10. Casualties have been zero since the operation officially started. The men have a system for vehicle formation and a certain path that minimizes the undead attraction back to Hotel 23. Most of these men had at least one tour in Iraq or Afghanistan under their belts, but they were the first to admit that convoy operations currently are much more dangerous than they were during the war. The gunny still insists on the H&K, and I still insist on American metal. We will be traveling light to conserve fuel and are taking a 3-day food supply. Icarus. 30 September. Time, location, unknown. Situation, bad. Surviving 24 hours, not looking up. Must keep record. The trip going as planned until aft fading in and out of consciousness, head swollen, ear bleeding, bloody hands. 30 September. Making a point to document in the event that I don't make it out. Will write more when better. Important. We were overhead Shreveport and decided to take it farther north since we had the fuel and a known fuel source. I was not watching instruments as Bayham was doing the driving. A light came on the master caution panel. It was the chip light. Bayham recycled the light to see if it was simply a short in the panel. It illuminated once again, indicating that there were pieces of metal detected in the aircraft oil reservoir. The normal procedure would be to land the aircraft immediately, but none of us wished to land in the known hostile territory below. It was not long until we lost useful power to the rotors and Bayham began auto-rotating down to the ground. The altimeter was spinning as if we were coming in for approach. The gunny and the petty officer were strapped in side by side in the rear of the aircraft. I was strapped in the co-pilot seat. The last thing I remembered was an ear-splitting noise and the sound of metal tearing and water and dust flying upward over the chopper and across my face. I don't know how long I was out. I was dreaming. It was a nice place. I was with Tara, but not at the compound. I was back in time, in the living world. It felt very real. Then came the light taps on my shoulder, then the pulling of my sleeve. Someone was waking me up from this feeling of tranquility. I started to feel my head. Intense pain shot through my temples. Every time my heart beat, I felt the blood surge through my head in spikes of pain. My vision was blurry. I was back in the helicopter, away from my fantasy. Still blurry. I looked to my left in the pilot seat. I could see Bayham looking at me, shaking my shoulder with his right hand, saying something. Why was he pulling on me? I looked back over my shoulder and saw Gunny and the engineer reaching out as if trying to help me. I seemed to be looking at them through a pool of water. The pain spiked again, and my eyes slowly came into focus. I looked over at Bayham. Fear shot through my body as I looked at his chest. A piece of the helicopter's rotor blade was sticking through his breastplate. He wasn't dying. He was dead. His taps, nudges, and what I thought was him talking were not attempts to wake me, but attempts to kill. He was still stuck in his harness and unable to reach me. I sat there, stunned for a moment, before looking back over my shoulders at the gunny and flight engineer. I was the only living person on this helicopter. Reaching up to my forehead, I felt a sting. A piece of rotor shrapnel had pierced my flight helmet and was stuck in my head. I didn't know how deep. I just knew that I was still alive and had cognitive function. I reached down for my carbine so that I could take out the rest of the crew and safely exfiltrate this tomb. When I tried to yank the carbine up to my shoulder, I saw that the barrel had been bent at almost a 90-degree angle and was caught inside the flight controls at my feet. Cursing, I threw the weapon on the deck and looked around the chopper for anything I could use. The gunny's MP5 was on the floor behind my seat. I took out my knife and used it to snag the sling to bring the weapon close enough so that I could grab it. Charging the weapon, I first aimed at Bayham. His snarling teeth and sagging old skin were enhanced by his current health status. He didn't know me anymore. Neither did the men in the back. I was going to save the gunny for last. I pulled the weapon up, and Bayham began slapping the suppressor around, as if somehow he knew what was coming. I wasted him. 1 second later, I shot the engineer in the head. His arms went from Frankenstein to limp, as if he had never been reanimated. I said some words for all of them, and then paid final respects to the gunny by shooting him in the forehead. I hoped he would have done the same for me. Looking out the window, I could tell that we had been here for at least a couple of hours, as the sun was already nearly at its apex in the day sky. We were in the middle of some sort of waist-deep small pond. A tinge of guilt stabbed me in the heart when I realized Bayham had probably thought our best chance of survival was to put it down here. I had paid him back by quick-acting lead poisoning. It was a good place to crash land, as the port side door was off its rail, exposing the aircraft to the outside world. There were numerous undead curiously circling the pond, somehow repelled by the water. I carefully surveyed the 360-degree area and noticed a gap in them. I grabbed my gear and whatever else I could carry. As I walked to the door to escape the wreck, I ripped the Velcro flag off my left shoulder and slapped it in the gunny's dead hand. I made for the door. As I stepped off the chopper, I sank waist-deep into the water. This made it difficult to quickly move to the open area for my escape. I was nearly swimming to the shore of the small pond. I made it to dry land and began running. I blacked out shortly after and woke up about 4 hours ago. I am sitting in a high school football stadium announcer's box at the top of the home side, I think. It is nightfall, and I am hungry and dehydrated. I had to perform minor surgery on myself an hour ago by removing the metal shard from my head with the needle nose on my multi-tool. Using the mirror for my camouflage paint kit, I stitched myself up with the sewing kit in my bag. The shard went more than an eighth of an inch into my head, above my left temple. I do not know at this time if this injury is life-threatening. I have limited food and water, but I am conserving as much as possible to prolong survival. This could be the end. I hear footsteps on the metal bleachers below. 01 October. Time unknown. It's coming back to me in flashes. I vaguely remember fighting three of them. They must have seen me make for the top of the bleachers and followed. When I woke up, I was flat on my back, lying in a pool of blood and broken glass in the center of the floor of the press box. As I tried to lift my head up and check the door, I noticed the shatterproof glass. From the looks of it, I shot through the glass to kill the things, but missed, as the bullet holes are accompanied by larger holes. The edges of the larger holes in the broken glass hold pieces of skin and clothing, indicating they tried to reach inside. There is also a diagonal line of bullet holes starting from the doorknob and trailing down to the bottom left part of the door. After checking my weapon, I figured that I had shot between 15 and 20 rounds. Forcing myself to my feet, I stumbled over to the door. Looking through the broken glass, I saw four dead bodies strewn on the bleachers. In the distance, I could see another two beyond the goalpost, milling about in search of prey. My memory is still spotty, but I remember shooting at least one of them at point-blank range, right through the glass, killing it instantly. 02 October. Approximately 1600 hours. Woke up this morning to the sound of a dog howling. It could have been a wolf, but with the lack of living humans in North America, I'm certain all the domestic dogs are becoming feral. I'm curious if they would remember me as a living man, or attack me on sight as they do the undead. I have seen a canine's resentment of them. Reminds me of how some dogs despise uniforms. Annabelle dislikes the creatures, and the hackles on her back stand up the instant she smells one of them drawing near. I have dried blood all over my face, and I continue to inhabit the crow's nest above an overgrown football field. The only evidence that remains that it was ever a playing field is the goalposts and the bleachers on either side. I am beat up and sore. The crash may have injured me seriously. My kidney area is extremely tender, and I find it difficult to stand for very long. In the packs I grabbed from the helicopter, I salvaged 300 9mm rounds, 5 MREs, and a collapsed roll of rigging tape. I'm somewhat encouraged by the fact that I had the forethought to grab my pack with my multi-tool, 2 gallons of water, and NVGs, along with other survival odds and ends. I will try to keep myself to 1 quart of water per day. If I don't overexert myself, I feel I may have enough water to get healthy enough to move. I also have the equipment that was strapped to my vest under the harness when we crashed. Pistol, survival knife, flares, compass. The stitches in my head are very uncomfortable, and I wish that I had had something better than sewing thread. A bottle of vodka or any hard alcohol would really help. I have a handheld PRC-90 survival radio that I have been using to try to communicate with Hotel 23 on frequencies 2828 and 243. No joy. Either I am out of range or the radio isn't operating properly. John knew our intended flight path, but even if every Marine were dispatched with all vehicles and weapons, they wouldn't make it as far north as my location. There are simply too many undead between us. I don't think I'll be making it back at this point. 03 October, approximately 1900 hours. It is time to begin formulating a plan. I'm down to 1.5 gallons of water, and the number of undead in and around the field seems to be increasing. I find it difficult to think with the pain I'm experiencing. I keep telling myself to bring it back to basics. I need food, water, and shelter. In today's day and age, that isn't enough. As of this very minute, I can see 6 of the creatures from my vantage point. They don't seem to know I'm here, and not one of them has made an attempt at the bleachers. With the range and accuracy of the MP5, I dare not make any attempts to take them out, especially by the grainy green picture provided by my goggles. The pain in my head is driving me mad. I've thought on a couple of occasions of just leaving the box, going down to the field and killing them all from behind with my knife. Then the pain subsides, and I go back to reality and realize what a shit plan that is. When I urinate, I can see small amounts of blood. I figured this out when I accidentally pissed all over my hands today. I must have really socked my kidney when the helicopter auto-rotated to the ground. First off, I need to figure out exactly where I am. After I do that, I need to figure out where I can go to get some better gear and try to communicate with Hotel 23. At this point, I'm positive they know the aircraft is down. I will rest and recover until I get down to 0.5 gallon of water. I have decided that, at that point, staying could mean death. It's getting cold here at night, especially when you're only wearing 2 layers of clothing and have a door with as much unintended ventilation as mine. Damn myself for getting so used to being around others. My watch is busted, only showing the day under the dead hour and minute hands. I suppose I can just kill one of those things and take its watch. I need to know the exact time of day so that I can monitor sunrise and sunset. It's been about 9 months since a watch battery has been manufactured. I'm sure they have a decent shelf life, so I might as well get a digital watch with a timer and chronometer while I can still use one. It's a shame I have to think of shit like this in my condition. 04 October, approximately 0200 hours. Another one of those things found its way up the bleachers at around midnight. I slid on my NVGs, trying to make sure when I turned them on that no green light would spill out around my eyes. I watched the corpse for 5 minutes as it stood there in front of the door at the top of the bleachers. Then, the batteries on my NVGs slowly started to fade out. I didn't have any more AA batteries in my pack, so I was forced to sit there in terror as the thing slid its hand in and around the broken glass. Every piece of glass that hit the floor sounded like thunder to me. I came very close to turning on my flashlight, but kept the urge at bay, knowing that it would attract more of them. It reminded me of the scene from a dinosaur movie when the girl just couldn't bring herself to turn the flashlight off to avoid being eaten by a tyrannosaur. The only difference was, I was the scared girl who couldn't turn the light on. Now, my species was becoming extinct. After about 30 minutes of mental torture, the thing slipped and fell backward down the steps and hasn't come back up since. I thought the sound of its falling would bring more, but so far, this hasn't happened. I should really pick up some batteries the next time I go shopping. For now, I have a tiny red LED light that I keep attached to my flight suit zipper. Writing this down in red light doesn't seem to affect my night vision, and the red light does not attract them. It is such a low-power LED that the creatures have not reacted to it as I sit here writing this. Approximately 0600 hours. The sun is peeking up above the trees. The glow of the morning is lighting up the area and revealing the undead milling about below, around where the 50-yard line should be. The windsocks on the goalposts are floating on the morning breeze. I didn't get to sleep until about 3 hours ago, and even then I woke up to every sound, every expansion and contraction of the bleachers heated by the morning sun. This press box is starting to smell very bad. The bucket in the corner is filling up fast, and the smell is starting to really fuck me up. I've noticed that the blood in my urine went away. My kidney area is still sore, but not as bad as 2 days ago. I miss home. Was it the smoldering and burning San Antonio? Was it Arkansas? Was it Hotel 23? This is all cloudy to me right now. I just want to go home. Somewhere happy. Somewhere devoid of death and destruction. I wish that I could have good dreams, because that is the only way I can escape this. Caller. 05 October. Early AM. Water is all but gone. I maybe have the bottom eighth of a gallon left. When the chopper went down, we were headed north from Shreveport. I don't know my exact location, but after careful consideration, I have decided to head southwest, back in the general direction of Hotel 23. I need clean water to cleanse my head injury. Pus is seeping out of the open wound, and I have to squeeze it every few hours to relieve the pressure. It's also very hot around the laceration. At least I know my body is fighting the infection. I would normally move at night, but my water situation has forced me out into the dead world again. There are about a dozen creatures below, and I know they will see or hear me when I leave the press box, as I'm not about to attempt to climb down behind the bleachers and risk a broken leg. I've been thinking a little more about writing down what has been going on. I think I might ditch this for the time being, as I am busy trying to get back, and writing in this situation could prove unhealthy. Fatal. I must confess that I tried to stop, but it didn't last long. I write when I can, and it makes me feel better. It may be sporadic, or it may reflect my boredom at times, but I stay more sane putting all this shit on paper. As I write this, I'm trying to remember all my bank PIN numbers and email password from before. I've had an account at my credit union for over 10 years with the same PIN, and I can't remember it. I had to really concentrate to remember my email password, the same one I used every day for years until the shit hit the fan. Email password, n@1radi@tor. I've packed my go bag, loaded the MP5, and put all the frequently needed items at the top of my bag for speed and convenience. Using a collapsed roll of rigging tape, I taped my knife sheath and survival knife to the left shoulder strap of my pack with the handle down. I want easy and quick access to it if I need to get personal with one of those things. I've rested enough that I think I can make it somewhere, and maybe with luck, hold up for a bit. I'm going to leave in 1 hour. Late PM. I went to battle at the football field today. I stepped down out of the press box after gulping down the last bit of water. My pack was full and tight against my body, making my lower back hurt a bit. The first contestant on The Headshot Is Right was a young male wearing one sneaker and a fucked-up green 7-Up t-shirt. He saw me come out of the box and immediately stumbled up the stairs. I still wasn't sure of myself with this weapon, so I let him get pretty close before the action chambered back and the top of his head flipped open like a cookie jar lid. He fell backward, making the bone in his leg snap louder than the bullet that ended him. More witnessed what I had done and came for me. Again, I had to deal with the talented Tenth, a very different talented Tenth than W.E.B. Du Bois. In my recent travels and travails, I've noticed that about 1 in 10 of these things is either smarter, faster, or both than their compatriots. I picked her out immediately. She was more aware and came at me with more coordination than the rest. She stood upright and walked briskly to me, while the others just stumbled. I gave her no quarter and shot her in the neck and head. She went down just as easily as the others, but she probably came from a hot zone. She wasn't as radiated as the horrendous creature on the Coast Guard cutter, but I knew the odd effect radiation had on them. It kept them on a more level playing field with the living. Me. I didn't take care of all of them at the field. I just killed enough of them to keep the threat at a manageable level. My plan was to kill the ones I needed to, fall back to the far side of the field, and circle around and retreat. I killed 4 and kept an eye on the other 8. I tried to get a good look at their wrists, because I would be willing to make 2 passes if, on the second pass, I could pick up a watch from one of them. I couldn't get a good look, and quite frankly, I was a little scared to linger on that field. I made 1 pass and evacuated the area, heading southwest by compass, until I came upon a sign that said, Oil City, 10 miles. I was at an intersection of the rural road and a 2-lane highway. I walked a 10-yard offset to the road to avoid being seen by anything. In my experience in this world, I've noticed the most lethal enemies are not the dead. From my vantage point at the crossroads, I could see an old roadblock set up on the southbound side of the highway and a 40-car pileup on the northbound side. A small creek trickled from a drainage pipe near the road. I decided that my need of water temporarily outweighed my need to remain invisible, so I ventured over to the sound of the water. As I approached the barrel-sized drain, I could swear I saw movement near the distant roadblock. I stood there for a full minute, just to make sure. Whatever it was, it didn't move again. I bent down and drank water until the sound of something caught my attention. I picked up my head so fast I hit the back of it on the top of the drain, temporarily causing me to see stars. I shook it off and kept listening. I made out the sound of an engine, cycling in a rhythmic pitch. It wasn't unlike an electric lawnmower. I tried to look in the direction I thought it was coming from, but I couldn't see it, no matter how much I strained my eyes. The sound vanished as quickly as it had come. I sat for a while, thinking of what it could be. Motorcycle? No. It didn't seem like that at all. It was something familiar. I drank until I couldn't anymore, filled up the water reservoir in my pack, and moved on, keeping the 30-foot offset. I saw all sorts of things that a man should never see along the way. Rotting corpses were strewn in and around the roadblock. They seemed to lie in a bed of expended brass, as if an army had attempted to dispatch a horde of them here months ago. There were dead men standing on the highway in a hibernating daze, presumably with nothing to motivate them. I suppose they conserve energy that way. In the distance, I could see a pack of dogs running across a field. I was downwind, so I'm pretty sure they didn't know I was near. There were no signs of human life whatsoever. The sun was getting lower in the sky, and it was time for me to find some shelter for the evening so that I could attempt to relax my nerves and collect some thoughts. It must have been 2 or 3 miles from the intersection that I noticed a house sitting behind a tree line in the distance. I carefully approached, watching all sides and looking over my shoulder much more than I needed to. It was very quiet, and I was still shaken up from the day's events. My kidney was full of water, and I had to pee. I thought back to playing hide-and-seek as a child, having to pee at all the wrong times. The house was an old 1950s-era two-story. The paint was peeling off it seemingly before my eyes. I sat and watched it for a very long time. I took notice of the burned-out late-model Chevy sitting a few meters to the side of the house. There were bullet holes in the hood and carriage. The first-floor windows of the home were boarded over, and old human remains were on the ground below the windows. I listened and watched until the fading light forced me to make a decision. The house seemed abandoned. I walked around it, looking for possible entry points. Even the front and back doors were boarded over. The only way in was to climb onto the roof and go in the unboarded upstairs windows. I mustered all the courage I had and pulled my sore body up the porch pillar and onto the overhang leading to an upstairs window. I never would have made it had I not done pull-ups with the Marines every day back home. I sat up there, admiring the view, and listened to my surroundings. It was dark behind the window, so dark that I would not want to be in there for anything. The window was raised about 6 inches, giving airflow to a part of the thin white curtain. It blew in the breeze, or perhaps it was my breathing that was causing the curtain to flutter. I held off for what seemed like hours. I didn't want to go in. I debated sleeping outside, but quickly ruled that out due to fear that I would roll off the roof and into the waiting arms of the dead. The sun's light was filtered red through the atmosphere as it said its goodbye with my spirits on the western horizon. I reached into my pack and grabbed my flashlight. I held my arm out to the window, and it felt almost electric as I touched it. I tried to pull it up with one hand, but it had been in that position so long that it wouldn't give. Using both my arms as well as my legs, I was able to get it high enough so that I could crawl in. I parted the curtain and twisted the tail cap on my light. The room appeared as normal as a room in an abandoned home could appear. The door was shut, the bed was made, but there were bird droppings and leaves all over the floor. I poked my head farther into the window to make sure it was clear all around. I was satisfied, so I crawled in. The first thing on my mind was the door and whether it was locked. I slowly walked over to the door, feeling the wood floor creak under my weight. After every sound I made, I stopped in my tracks and listened for any reaction in the hall or downstairs. I heard none. I reached up and checked the lock on the bedroom door. It was already locked from the inside. I then quietly checked the closet and under the bed and everywhere else boogeymen dwell. There was a burned candle and half a box of matches on the dresser. I debated whether I should light the candle to conserve my flashlight batteries. After some thought, I closed the curtain on the bedroom windows and quietly hung extra blankets from the closet over them. I lit the candle and warmed my hands over its flame. My eyes eventually adjusted to the candlelight, and I began to drift off into something. Not sleep, but something. I wasn't sure how long I had nodded off, but the sound of thunder startled me awake. I looked down at the candle and noticed that it had not burned down that much. I walked over to the window and pulled the blanket aside, looking out into the field. The lightning struck, revealing a human silhouette off in the distance. I had no idea of the creature's status or intent. It kept gazing out into the void, waiting for the lightning strikes to reveal the night. Eventually, the shape went away, and I wondered if I had ever seen it in the first place. It is still raining now, and I have decided to use the bed. No noise has come from the other side of the door, but I'll be sleeping with my weapon again tonight, and probably every night for the rest of my life. 06, October. I awoke this morning to nothing but the sound of the wind outside. I needed to eat. I have 3 MREs left from the crash. I've only eaten bits and pieces of them since then. I think today is a good day to force more food into my system. My head feels a little better. The stitches itch, but I'm trying not to touch. As I look out the window into the distance, I can see no sign of the undead. It's dreary outside, and it looks like it might storm again. I started to stretch my body out and get ready for the day when I remembered the most important thing in my life right now, the downstairs portion of this house. I let my mind slip for a second. For the first time in a long time, I forgot where I was. It seemed like I had been in this room for days, but it had only been one night. My mind relayed to my subconscious that the home was safe, that it was mine. Of course, this was not the situation. There could very well be a dozen of them down there, standing in a dormant trance, unaware of my presence. They seem to go into some sort of strange hibernation when there is no food or stimulus near. I could imagine a whole family of them, standing downstairs in a daze, waiting for the first sign of life to wake them into hunter-killer mode. I tried not to ponder exploring the house until I had eaten some sponge cake from my pack. After eating, I gulped down some water and started thinking of excuses not to go downstairs and look around. I knew that I had to, because there were things in this house that could keep me alive. It wasn't until the sun had crept through the clouds and was high in the sky that I decided to move on to the bottom floor. I checked my weapon over and rigged my LED light to the suppressor of the MP5 using the duct tape I had in my pack. I pulled the slide of my Glock back a quarter inch to make sure I could see brass in the hole. No part of my body was exposed as I reached out with my left hand to unlock the door. It was stuck, probably from being in one position for months. I had to force it open, making a loud clicking sound. I placed my hand on the door, securing it as I listened. If the noise brought them, I would lock it and head for the hills. I waited for at least 5 minutes, thinking I heard everything from the undead to a lawnmower to a foghorn. I released my hand from the door and reached down to turn the knob, presumably the first time it had been turned in ages. Twisting the knob, I readied my right hand to kill whatever stood in my way. The tape suppressor of my weapon was the first part of me to make it through the door. The blue tint of LED light lit up the upstairs common area as I panned my weapon around. I kept wondering whether I had actually checked my magazine or if I had just imagined it. Pushing that thought out of my head, I advanced. I looked back at the bedroom door I had just walked through. There were old bloodstains on the door, as if something had beaten on it until it lost interest. These things know. Swinging back around, I noticed something odd. There were white spots on the wall where pictures would have been. It's as if the owners of the house made sure to take the pictures with them. I can think of a few hundred more important things than pictures to take. There were dead flies all over the floor, as common as dust. The upstairs floor was covered in layers of both, with no footprints to indicate recent activity. If there was something dead or alive in this house, it had never bothered to wander around up here. This was when I found out why. As I crept to the stairs, almost stepping down, I stopped and looked down at my feet. There were only two steps before they disappeared. Someone had taken them out. Below were the bodies of six undead, all shot through the head. It was starting to make sense. Whoever owned this place had probably taken out the stairs and bugged out to the second floor. They had most likely shot the ghouls and retreated out the bedroom window. That's the best I could figure. That still didn't explain the bloodstains on the door I had come from, or how the things got into the house, but I hadn't checked the hole upstairs yet. I steered clear of the area of the floor near the damaged staircase and slowly made my way to the two closed doors at the other end of the hall. The floor creaked as I walked, but I ignored the sound. I didn't sense anything was here. The first door I came to was an upstairs bathroom. If the power had been on, it would have looked like any bathroom did before the dead came back. Everything was neatly in place, with dust-covered towels draped over the shower rod and a new bar of soap sitting in the soap holder near the sink. I swiped it up and zipped it in my leg pocket. I went over to the toilet and looked around. Nothing out of the ordinary but a weird little plaster mold in the shape of a toilet seat sitting on top of the toilet tank that read, "If you sprinkle when you tinkle, be a sweetie and wipe the seatie." For some reason I thought that was funny, and chuckled there for a couple of minutes. Before walking out of the bathroom, I checked under the sink and found a plastic container full of various medications. I took a tube full of expired triple antibiotic and a roll of toilet paper and moved on to door number 2. I readied my weapon as I opened the door. It was pitch black inside, with heavy curtains over the windows. I panned my light around the room, revealing its disheveled condition. The bed's mattress was flipped over, and dirty clothes and trash littered the floor. Small rat droppings were spread all over the room, adding to the room's old book smell. I was letting my imagination go wild before I went into these rooms, half expecting to see something horrible and demented. I was certainly happy not to find an old lady swinging by her neck from a light fixture in a failed attempt to kill herself properly. Swinging by her purple neck, screeching out in a witch's voice, "Be a sweetie and wipe the city!" Not today, thank goodness. The downstairs remained unexplored, but I didn't like the idea of climbing down there only to get my ass bitten off by a crafty ghoul. I doubt any of them are crafty, but I've seen them do increasingly weird things since they started reanimating. I suppose that alone is weird. After careful consideration, I decided to take the small hand mirror from the upstairs bathroom and use the rigging tape to attach it to a broom handle from the upstairs closet so that I could get a better view of the downstairs without having to risk my own ass. I was at the top of the destroyed stairs on my stomach for 20 minutes, looking around with the broom mirror, before I decided it might be safe enough to go down. The only thing that was out of the ordinary were the dead bodies on the floor below and an open door that looked like it could lead down into some sort of basement. I was so paranoid of falling down into the bodies below that I tied my leg to the sturdy upstairs railing. I'd have hated to find myself face down on a pile of corpses with more pouring out of the open door and no quick way back upstairs. Using the same dirty sheets I used to tie my leg, I made a makeshift rope ladder for my descent. Feeling more frightened than on my first day of school, I quickly climbed down and immediately sped over to close the open door. Approaching the door, I noticed that there were definitely stairs leading down into the dark abyss. I didn't care if those stairs led to a cache of M16s and a year's worth of food. I wasn't going down there, not after what I've been through. I shut the door and scooted a large couch in front of it as quietly as I could. After I was certain that the basement door was secure, I began methodically clearing the bottom floor of any perceived threats. Closet by closet, nook by cranny, I made sure that none of those things were down there with me. I checked everywhere, making sure that not even a severed upper torso could be hiding in wait for me under a table or in a downstairs shower. Satisfied that the house was clear enough, I began searching for items that I needed. I went through the drawers in the kitchen, finding waterproof matches and 3 packs of AA batteries. My NVGs were again serviceable. Further investigation revealed an old box with 2 large rat traps inside. I took these traps, as I felt they were easily large enough to take a small rabbit or a squirrel when my ready reserve food ran out. In reality, I should have been hunting to preserve my non-perishables, and I may begin to do so as soon as I feel a little stronger. In a downstairs closet, I found a black and gray hiking pack with Arc'teryx Bora 95 embroidered on it in gold letters. The pack was clearly of higher quality and more comfortable than the one I was using, and looked like it could hold twice as much. I walked over to the bashed staircase, careful not to touch the bodies on the floor. After reaching up to shove the pack onto the second floor, I continued my investigation. I walked around the lower level of the house, checking out the boarded-over windows and reinforced door. Propped up next to one of the windows to the left of the door was a long mop handle with an ice pick bound to the end. The pick was attached with skill, the twine holding it in place showing intricate knots that formed a pattern, holding the pick very securely to the end. Brown, dried blood covered the metallic end of this homemade spear. It wouldn't be good for hunting an animal, but if you hit one of those things in the eye, or the tender part of the rotting skull, you could bring it down without a shot, saving valuable resources. I took the makeshift weapon and placed it on the kitchen counter. When I went back into the main area where I had made my descent, I heard a creaking sound. I sat still, and it happened again. My main fear was that it was coming from the basement area. I walked over to the boarded-up door to take a look outside so that I could make sure I had a clear escape out the front door. As I brought my eye level to the peephole, the outline of a dead man projected into my pupil. I was terrified for a moment, just gazing at it, unable to look away. Its skeletal face was no more than a foot from me on the other side of the door. I wanted badly to shoot the thing through the peephole, but I would probably have missed and complicated things with the noise it would make splintering the wood. I couldn't take my eye off this train wreck. The face was rotted, the milky eyes bugged out, and the lips were gone. The thing seemed to stare at me through the door. It didn't move a millimeter the whole time I watched. The creature must have been over 6 feet tall. Standing on my tiptoes, I tried to look down at an object in the creature's rotten grip. I couldn't quite make out what it was. I waited at the door, only pausing my peek to blink so that my eyes wouldn't dry up. It didn't budge. My choices were limited. I could either sneak back upstairs by climbing the sheet and call it a day, or dispatch the creature once and for all at that moment. I chose to quietly look around the house for more supplies that could be of use before going back upstairs. Moving like a cat, I went back into the kitchen to check the cupboard. I caused a slight creak in the floor as I crossed the kitchen's threshold. I paused for a few minutes, listening. Creak, creak, was the sound from just outside the front door. I dismissed the threat, half imagining the creature cocking its head from side to side, trying to decide if it had made the noise or if it was made by some tasty morsel on the inside. Checking the shelves in the cupboard, I found 6 cans of chili, no meat, 2 cans of vegetable beef stew, and various other foods in advanced stages of decomposition. I shoved the cans into my pack and looked under the sink for anything of use. Under the sink sat an old rat trap identical to the two that I had taken earlier. Only the skeletal remains and shriveled tail of the long-ago tricked rat were present. Satisfied with my find, I grabbed the mop handle with the ice pick and crept back to the improvised rope ladder, fighting back the unnatural urge to peek through the peephole again. Using the mop handle, I carefully raised my pack to the second floor so that it would be easier for me to climb up. The pack was overfilled and too heavy, so I wobbled a bit, trying to keep it balanced. A can of chili fell out and hit the floor, making a sound so loud that it might as well have been artillery fire. I cringed as I shoved the pack up onto the second floor next to the larger empty pack. As I bent down to pick up the can of food, a loud banging sound erupted from the front door. The thing must have been hitting the door with something, as it sounded harder and louder than a bare hand. I shoved the can into one of the pockets in my vest and nearly jumped to the second floor. I lay there on the top floor, using my pack as a pillow and looking at the ceiling, as the monster kept the time for me by door wax. Relentlessly, it kept on. I heard the door splinter some and decided to use the mirror to watch the door. I jumped and shook a little every time the creature hit the door, making the mirror shake in my grip. A very small beam of sunlight was poking through a hole in the door about 2 feet above the knob. Blunt objects don't cause damage like that. The door was boarded in three places, and I remember it being boarded on the outside as well. I retreated into the bedroom I had previously commandeered and locked myself in as the sun dipped to the horizon. It would be dark soon. Using my multi-tool, I opened a can of chili and pulled out my brown plastic MRE spoon. I sat there, counting the thumps downstairs as the sun set. It took me 353 thumps to finish my chili. Night run. 06 October. Late PM. From the sounds below, I can tell that the thing is all but inside. I heard a board hit the floor about a half an hour ago. Of course, I don't have any idea what half an hour is anymore. In the fear that it may draw more of its own, I've decided to use the night as cover and escape from this place. I spent the evening stuffing the new pack I scavenged from downstairs. I've rearranged everything so that the most needed items will be on top or in a compartment near one of the zippers. There is a lot of extra room in my bag, so I'm grabbing a green wool blanket from the closet. I checked the batteries that I acquired from downstairs. They don't expire for 6 more years. I put them in the NVGs and turn them on. The green light shining from the optics onto my palm indicated that they were working fine. No use looking through them with the candlelight shining. I also tried my handheld radio again. I didn't hear anything but static. My mind was playing tricks on me as I thought I heard voices on the other end. I transmitted my situation in the blind, but was vague on my location. Maybe when I get farther south, I'll use the memorized codes that John insisted I learn. My stitches are itching again, so I tried the antibiotic ointment. I hope it will help fight off any infection. In a few more days, I'll be cutting the stitches out. It's time to blow out the candle. 07 October. Early AM. I'm not certain why these things are the way that they are, or why they are different, more aggressive and persistent. When I departed the house last night, I did so from the same window I entered. I made the bed, mostly because it made me feel better to do so, but also because it postponed my inevitable departure. After making the bed, I doused the light and put on my NVGs. As I adjusted them, my fears became reality when I saw that the noise the creature made downstairs had drawn a dozen more undead to the area. That was just what I could count from one window. By my estimation, there were probably nearly 30 around the house. As I made my way out onto the roof, I could hear the sounds of them moving through tall grass and tripping over branches, trying to locate the noise in the dark. Old habits die hard, and I knew I had 29 rounds of ammo in each of my magazines, even though it didn't matter with this weapon. I carefully moved to the edge and looked down. There were two below. Leaning over the edge, I popped both of them, missing the head of one. The one I hit fell into the other, giving me another chance. I shot number two and started climbing down the side of the house the same way I had come up. Moving to my best evasion route, I killed three more. Each trigger pull illuminated the surrounding area with a green flash. The NVGs were magnifying the flash from the tip of the suppressor. I was much too tired to sprint. I walked at a near jog, simply dodging them. I looked back toward the house as I neared the road. One of those things seemed to be nearly running in my direction. For a moment, I thought that it could actually see me in the dark. My fears subsided when it moved off to the side and stopped. It seemingly sniffed the air and slowly turned its head from side to side as if trying to sense me. It held an object of some sort in hand. My gut told me that it was the same creature I had seen through the peephole. I started to move away from it and turned to the road. I had no idea where I was going. I traveled south for miles along an old paved highway, stepping over cracks so as not to break my mother's back. The signs indicated that I was closing in on Oil City. This road might even take me into Shreveport, a city that I dared not enter. I needed a place to sleep tonight. I walked until I could almost see a bit of light on the horizon, meaning that the sun would be up soon. I could make out a school bus up ahead on the road. My best guess was that it was about 04:30 hours. The cold was getting to me, and I needed at least a couple of hours of sleep to face the coming day. I kept heading toward the bus, careful to scan my surroundings. The area seemed clear, but there were a lot of unknowns. A few derelict cars and trucks littered the side of the road on the way to the bus. Rotted skeletons were strewn about near the vehicles, picked clean by the dead and the birds. Approaching the bus, I was happy to see that the door was open, telling me that at least nothing was trapped inside and too dumb to let itself out. Carefully maneuvering to the front, I climbed the bumper and stepped up onto the hood. The bus was slippery from the morning dew. From the hood, I looked into the front window down the rows of seats. It was empty. I climbed onto the roof of the bus to get a better 360-degree view of the area. There was no movement except for two small rabbits in the ditch. I thought about shooting them, but it was too dark to risk even that slight noise. I took the wool blanket out of my pack and left the pack on the roof of the bus. I climbed back down the hood and entered the bus door. Throwing the blanket onto the bus driver's seat, I knelt and pointed my SMG under the seats. I could see nothing but an old paper lunch sack. I reached over and closed the bus door with the manual crank lever as slowly as I could, making sure to minimize the noise it made. Sadly, this isn't the first time I've slept in a bus. With my pack safely on the roof, I could escape out any of the windows and retrieve it if I needed to make a quick departure. If I had kept my pack inside, I might not have been able to fit it through the window, losing all my food and supplies if I had to run. I cut strips of vinyl from one of the seats on the bus and very sloppily braided it into a rope. I used this to tie the door handle in place to make sure that nothing could get in to see me without making a lot of noise. Time for sleep, if anyone would call it that. Late AM. It's about mid-morning now, and I'm sitting in the fourth seat back on the right side of the bus. I've slept a needed 4 hours, or so I think. My pack is still on the roof. There is no movement around me, and I'll probably climb up, get my things, and leave as soon as I'm sure it's safe. The more I think of Hotel 23, the more important it becomes for me to get back there to my family. Even though the thought of my parents being alive is still inside my head, I know that most likely they are dead. My home is no bunker, and just like every other home built in the United States in the past 50 years, my parents' home was not built to outlast a siege. I wonder how many people might still live if they made them like they used to. PM. Still the 7th. As I geared up to get my stuff off the top of the bus this morning, I was confronted with a very grim surprise. The bastard from the house had somehow followed me. I was on the hood of the bus, about to climb to the roof, when I heard the sound of steel on steel. The sound startled me so much I nearly fell off the hood and flat on my back. I jumped forward into the bus window, causing it to crack. Looking over my shoulder, I knew instantly that it was the creature, the same apparition that stared at me through the peephole at the old house. How could this dumb thing know anything about following me? An even better question was, how did this thing know how to swing a hatchet? I jumped onto the roof of the bus and just watched the thing work with amazement. It was actually trying to climb up there with me. I wasn't making the same mistake this time. This member of the undead talented 10th had to go. I flipped the indicator on my weapon and blasted the creature in the face, dropping it instantly. The thing made a lot of noise before I killed it, so it was time for me to depart. Before leaving, I checked the creature for anything valuable, and lo and behold, it was wearing a beat-up plastic G-Shock wristwatch. I grabbed the watch and looked at the display before stuffing it in my pack along with the hatchet. The digital display read 10:07 and 12:23 p.m. I kept making my way south and west, passing scene upon scene of decay. How long had it been since I had seen the first of them? I walked and imagined how it would feel to talk to someone again. The feeling of loneliness was setting in. From all my experiences with survival, this was the most serious of all emotions. It is different with everyone, but for me, the emotion attached to being lonely is fear. I kept pushing the thought of the dead out of my consciousness, but I could not control what I was about to think. The daymare brought me to an open field that I was crossing to the wooded area beyond. As if in a scene from a war movie, as I approached the middle of the field, an army of radiated dead appeared at the crest of the hill. They immediately ran for me. Right before I could see the rot of their eyes, I snapped out of it and kept walking. There was no sound. Only the slight breath of wind on my face let me know that I was back to this reality.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.